For Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, Michigan Republicans can't account for some party money.
This is a big deal because state law requires political committees to make sure that their reporting to the public is accurate.
Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan staked his political future on one thing.
Is the population of this city going up or going down?
We'll take a look. Plus, a new documentary finds a juvenile sentenced to life in prison started his life of crime at the urging of the FBI.
A lot of people may not believe that, but the very agents who managed him appeared in this film and admitted all.
Remember White Boy Rick? And a new book on preserving 6,000 acres along Lake Michigan.
So many people rallied around to help preserve it. It was such a community effort.
And we'll hear from an artisan of Michigan. But first, let's get a news update. Welcome to Stateside. On this final day of March 2017, I'm Lester Graham. Imagine you're a teenager and the FBI urges you to become a drug informant. That's what happened to Richard Wershe Jr., better known as White Boy Rick. A documentary on his case premieres tonight at the Free Film Festival, and we'll speak with the director later this hour. Also, there was a settlement this week in a major lawsuit over the Flint water crisis. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith will tell us what that means for residents and taxpayers. And a recent book chronicles the story of preserving Lake Michigan shoreline from development. We'll hear from the author. But first, the Republican leadership in the Michigan House is trying to find some missing money. The House Republican Campaign Committee raised a lot of money for candidates in the last election cycle, but cannot account for all of it now. Joining me now are Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta from the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, Craig Mauger, who've been investigating this together. So, guys, how much money is missing?
Well, it looks like it's about $100,000, $103,000. That's what we found out as the result of a Freedom of Information Act request for communications between the committee and the Secretary of State's office, plus some highly placed sources that confirm the numbers.
Craig, I understand the committee spent something like $4 million during the last election cycle. If that's the case, we're talking about 2.5% of the funds, and I got to tell you, my checkbook could be off 2.5% on any given month. So why
we're
is
pretty
this
confident it is, Lester?
Why is we have this sources there as well.
Why is this a big deal?
This is a big deal because state law requires political committees to make sure that their reporting to the public is accurate. And if you start saying, well, they were just off by 2.5%, that undermines the entire disclosure process that we have in this state. The process is supposed to ensure that every dollar these committees spend is just about tracked and the public has the ability to look at it, judge where it went, and see if it was spent in a way that the public is okay with or not. That's what disclosure is about.
Yeah, $100,000 is, you know, it's an ad buy. It's a lot of brochures, radio spots. It could be a couple of campaign salaries.
Right, and all those things occurred to me as well. And I also thought, you know, PACs and committees donate to other PACs and committees a lot.
Yeah.
Could this just be a matter of omission?
Well, that's actually where the House Republican Campaign Committee gets a lot of its money, is just from donations from other political committees.
Yes.
That are led by political figures.
So what's being done to track down this $100,000 or so?
Yeah, so House Speaker Tom Leonard has ordered a financial review. I think it's a financial review. Some people are classifying it as an audit to figure out what happened with this money, to figure out what kinds of spending didn't show up in the reports. And then once they figure out among their own team what happened here, they're going to take that information to the Secretary of State's office and say, here are the mistakes we made. And the Secretary of State's office will probably, what we've seen before, is levy some type of penalty for not reporting properly. That's what most likely will happen.
So they're auditing themselves. They're not bringing in an independent auditor.
Right. That this is an internal audit. They've hired an attorney, Eric Doster, who's a well-known Republican attorney here in Lansing. And one of the benefits of reporting this is now this isn't happening in the dark, that everyone knows this and they're going to want to know details of the results of the audit and what the State Bureau of Elections decides to do about it.
I understand both the current Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard, and the previous Speaker, Kevin Cotter, had roles in this House Republican Campaign Committee. Who was on watch when this money went missing?
That is a question that is somewhat outstanding as to whom.
That's a big question.
Yeah, it's a huge question as to who will ultimately take the blame for this. And it will be a question that I'm sure different sides may have different takes on, but this audit that is currently ongoing will probably point the finger somewhere, I would think.
And what kind of timeline are we talking about, Rick?
I think we're thinking that maybe in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think they're expecting the audit to be wrapped up somewhat soon. What happens when it's completed? Does that become a public document? Those are all things that we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, right. It's a party. It's not open. It's not government. It's party.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. No, but they are certainly connected to the government. That they're how the government becomes the government.
We'll have a really good idea about what the audit found by they're going to have to file amended campaign finance reports that show where the mistakes were, and the public is definitely supposed to see those amendments, and it deserves to see those amendments.
That's Michigan Campaign Finance Network's Craig Mauger and Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Some cuts to water protection and an increase in money for the private firm providing food for state prisoners are a couple of the things making their way through the Michigan legislature right now. Here to talk about that are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator in the House. Ken, Paul Egan with the Detroit Free Press reports Florida-based Trinity Services Group was hit with a nearly $2.5 million in contract penalties for inadequate staffing levels and other problems when it was serving prison food. But a House Budget Subcommittee has approved a $4 million increase for Trinity. Most people who don't do an adequate job usually don't get a raise. Why is this happening?
Well, on the surface, this doesn't sound good. But actually, the contract that you're talking about is, I think, a fairly decent one. It's a multi-year contract. It has modest inflationary increases year by year, but then it has penalties in it.
Yeah, it's a three-year contract, right?
Yeah, it's a three-year contract, modest inflationary increases every year, but then it's performance-based. So there are penalties if you don't meet certain metrics, and that's what you see happening here. The increase is the inflationary increase that's in the contract. The penalties that you're talking about are the performance-based piece of the contract, and they're being penalized because they haven't met certain metrics. So when you look at it from that perspective, it's a pretty decent contract.
Vicki, the state signed a $158 million three-year contract in 2015. It'll be increased, as we said. Of course, it replaced Aramac, which had a number of problems, including reports of maggots in the kitchen. Aramac's contract was a $145 million three-year contract. This price is rising. Is private food services in Michigan's prisons still saving money for taxpayers?
They say it is. I just don't see the value of using private contractors in our prisons. We've had so many problems ever since we went to privatization that actually many of our guards are being moved to help in the kitchens and to help serve the food because the contractors are not coming in with skilled enough labor, with people who know what they're doing. They're being run roughshod over by the prisoners. So we're still using guards, taking them off their normal duty to go into the prison's kitchen when we're serving food. I just don't see how this is helping in the long run. The for-profit companies are skimping on the food. In fact, ever since we went to privatization, we've also stopped buying from local vendors and food vendors in Michigan. So this is actually costing local businesses a lot of money.
Ken, after the Flint water debacle, the governor is concerned about lead in the water. The House and Senate subcommittees approved budget proposals that cut Governor Rick's proposed funding for the Department of Environmental Quality. One part of it was $2.6 million to cut enforcement of the Safe Drinking Water Act as it pertains to lead in drinking water. Another $15 million for addressing contaminated sites around the state. What's the legislature thinking?
Well, I think what you're seeing is in most department budgets proposed by the governor, both the House and the Senate are trying to find some savings. So these cuts to the DEQ proposal from the governor are not, in one respect, unique. And they're trying to basically find enough money to position themselves for some kind of tax cut. on the DEQ cuts specifically, Republicans are in a tough spot. They've got to figure out a way to defend those cuts in the sense they're not going to compromise environmental protection, particularly focused on the drinking water issue. And you're right. Given what happened in Flint, I think Republicans are in a difficult spot if they think they can defend various cuts to that particular program, meaning drinking water protection. But they're looking for money for a tax cut.
Well, just the optics of that seem pretty interesting. Vicki, Michigan has this black eye because of lead contamination in Flint. Internationally, Michigan's known for cars, Detroit bankruptcy, and Flint's contaminated water. So why would you cut funding for dealing with lead in drinking water?
I don't know what's in the minds of the legislature. Again, I think Ken is correct. They're trying to find enough money to follow through on their tax cuts. On the other hand, you have a governor that has been really knocked down many pegs because of the Flint water crisis, and he's trying to reclaim a legacy. The fact is, we do have contaminated water throughout the state, not just in Flint. In Birmingham and in several school districts, we found higher than allowable levels of lead and copper in many of the sinks in laboratories and throughout the schools in Oakland County, so much so that the Oakland County Democratic commissioners are trying to find $500,000 to test all drinking water in Oakland County's public school system and in the nursery schools and the private support for early childhood schools. It is a problem. I don't know how the legislature can defend cost cutting in these particular programs.
That's Vicki Burnett. She's a Democrat, a former mayor of Farmington Hills, and a former legislator. Ken Sikkema is a Republican, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants, and a former legislative leader. Thanks, both of you. Have a nice weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
By the way, as you probably caught, I misspoke. I called the prison food contractor Aramark. The company's name is actually Aramark. You knew that. Coming up, an author shares her detailed account of saving dunes from development. And Michigan Radio's investigative reporter Lindsay Smith stops by to explain what the recent Flint water settlement means for residents. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. The city of Flint and the state of Michigan recently agreed to settle a lawsuit over the lead contamination of Flint's water. Last night, there was a public meeting in Flint explaining the details. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith was there, and she joins us now. Lindsay, remind us, who filed this lawsuit? How'd this go about?
This was one of the major lawsuits that was filed on behalf of one particular resident, along with the ACLU of Michigan and the Natural Resources Defense Council. And it was a lawsuit that was filed against the state and the city mainly. And it was seeking to solve the lead in water issues and basically trying to enforce the Safe Drinking Water Act, which requires lead levels to be at a certain lower than a certain level, which they had exceeded. So this was the big lawsuit that also tried to push, I don't know if you remember, the home delivery of bottled water. A judge had ruled in this case that the state had to do that last November.
Right.
They never really did it. They deliver to people who are homebound or that request it. And they were accused of kind of dragging their feet. But the state has held that at this point, the water in Flint is testing under federal limits. And so this settlement agreement really helps pave the path forward for how they're going to resolve some major kind of lingering questions about how they're going to solve the lead issues and how fast they have to do it and what they have to do.
Right. I understand there's some money to help remove the lead lines. How much and how many lines can be moved?
Yeah. So $30 million is not new. It's the same money that Congress passed in December. $67 million of this is new. It's from the state of Michigan. And with that money, that $97 million, they're going to be able to replace at least 18,000 lead and galvanized service lines. And they have 3 years to do that.
Overall, how many lead lines are there in Flint?
There's more than 18,000. So there is going to be some money set aside to kind of, I'm sort of gathering that they're going to see where they're at after that first 18,000 is out of there. But, I mean, really what it comes down to is you have to have a water bill, like you have to have an active water service. You don't need to be current on your water bill, but you have to have an active water service. They're not going to go through and rip out lead lines at vacant homes, which is obviously a big issue in Flint. So I see them kind of chipping away at, like, where's the priorities here? They're not going to do vacant homes. They're not going to do, you know, certain things like that. And you have to have an active water account. So I think that's where you're going to see some of the difference lie between the actual number of lead lines in the city and how many they'll end up replacing.
In the meantime, what about bottled water and faucet filters?
I think this is going to be a big issue in the coming months. As a part of this agreement, one of the big things besides the lead service line replacement, which is, by the way, that is just such a huge deal that's unprecedented in a court of law that says to the state, you must remove lead service lines. Without that court order, the city probably could have dragged this on for 10, 13 years, really, to be honest. So the filters is sort of the holdover. Until we get all of those lead lines replaced, we're going to continue to provide free filters, free cartridges for people. And the bottled water is going to probably be a controversy because a lot of people that I talk to in Flint, they don't trust the water filters, even though scientists have shown that they are removing significant numbers of or significant lead levels. But people don't trust it, and they'd rather drink bottled water. And so beginning in July, the state can start to close some of these pods, they're called, these churches and just different places around the city where you can go and pick up bottled water and pick up filters. There was a woman that I talked to, her name is Doris Allen, and she really predicts that, you know, as people start to find this out or when they start to close, that this is going to be a big issue.
It's going to be really bad for the kids, for the people that have children, and that are, and for senior citizens that are on fixed incomes who can't afford water, like me. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard. So when you take your shower, you say your prayers, you ask the Lord to bless the water, you run in, take your shower, and you get out. I pay my water bill because I got the shave and shower. That's it. That's what I use it for, you know. But cooking, no. Drinking, no. Mm-mm. Don't do that.
What's up next for Flint to recover from this lead contamination of the city's water?
Well, I think that the service line replacements are definitely going to be the biggest deal. You're also seeing these groups of people, they're called core teams, that are going door to door to every house in Flint and making sure that people, if they want to, I mean, I went along with some of these core teams, and not everybody is excited to have somebody knock at their door, as you can imagine. These people have a lot of people knocking at their doors and trying to sell them things or give them things or make sure they have things. And these core teams are going through and making sure that people have filters, that they're working properly, that they're kind of educated about the programs that are available. So I think you're going to see a lot more of these core teams really get a big push in the next few months, because as those pods start to close down over the summer, I mean, and the delivery of bottled water is going to also stop this summer, they really need to make sure that they get to everybody so that people at least have had an opportunity to get those free filters and to get the information that they need to have water that they can technically drink out of a filter.
That's Lindsay Smith with Michigan Radio, continuing our coverage of the Flint water crisis. Thanks, Lindsay.
Yep, no problem.
You're listening to Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's a classic story of fiction. Powerful corporation wants to develop a large tract of pristine land. Local folks band together, persuade politicians, raise money, and save the land. Except that story is real, and it happened in Michigan. A new nonfiction book is out. Its title is Saving Arcadia, A Story of Conservation and Community in the Great Lakes. The author is Heather Shoemaker, and she joins us now. First, tell us where this land, Arcadia Dunes, is located.
Well, it's right along, as you'd expect, dunes right along Lake Michigan's coastline, and it's a little bit south of Frankfort.
Can you describe it and the nearby Greenpoint Dunes for us?
Oh, well, at first you have to sort of fall under this gaze of wonder, because it brings awe. They're very, very tall sand dunes, and I like running down them with your hair kind of flying and just plunging down into Lake Michigan. But it's a pristine sugar sand beach at the bottom with Lake Michigan waves crashing around, and then a nice deserted sand dune that just towers above it. and then 6,000 acres of natural land and some farmland stretching around there. Greenpoint Dunes is sort of a bookend to Arcadia Dunes. They're two dunes that look at each other, and you can walk between them along the beach.
Now, people love nature for lots of reasons. Some love bird watching, some love hunting. You clearly love the unique and rare plants that grow in a place such as the Arcadia. Why are they important?
Well, so many of us love going out at different times of year to see what nature has to offer. But one thing that's very amazing about the sand dunes is that they have plant species and some animal species that that don't appear anywhere else on our planet. So they're called an endemic. They're a Great Lake species that lives just in this very narrow habitat, which not a lot of things can live on because the sand dunes, the sand is constantly blowing, and it's a harsh environment to live in. So the animals and plants that do make it their home have to have pretty good survival strategies.
Really adaptable, yeah. This land used to be owned by a lot of farm families back in the 1960s, but something came in and bought 6,000 acres. Who bought it and why?
Well, at first it was a big mystery. You know, somebody was going around, one man was going around knocking on all the farmers' doors, and everybody was speculating, who is this guy? They figured they had some big money behind him, but, you know, who was it and what was the big power behind him? It turned out to be the utility, Consumers Power, as it was called then. Now it's part of CMS Energy. And they were buying it originally to build a pump storage facility like the one they did build in Ludington. So what that is, it's flooding the land, and it had to be pretty high land, which is why they were attracted to the dune. So pouring that into a reservoir they were going to make, and then at times of peak energy demand, they would have released that water down into Lake Michigan and generating extra electricity. So the plan was to buy up this 6,000 acres, flood it, and use it for energy production.
And that's a big story in itself, but let's move on because I want to get to the fun stuff. But these CMS plans for the Lake Energy Scheme never came about. Then there was talk of resorts, big private residences, full-on development of the Arcadia Dunes. What happened to those plans?
Well, they were very close to being realized. But so many people during the time since this book spans a 40-year history. And during that 40 years when the land was not flooded and developed in various ways, it sat there rather empty. And people started to fall in love with it. So all the local folks would start hiking there or the camping, doing all sorts of things and getting to know it. So when the idea that it was really going to be developed, when this new plans came to have that be a serious threat, people were ready to rally for the land. And at the time, I worked for a land trust, the Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy up in Traverse City. And my job was to help preserve beautiful natural areas and turn them into protected land where people could hike and enjoy it and the species could continue to live their lives. So we decided to take on the daunting project of preserving this 6,000-acre tract of land.
I want to talk about some of these people. The way you describe the characters, the real people in your book, is through their idiosyncrasies rather than, you know, a summation of them. And I really like that. But all of those community members, they have that connection, as you mentioned, to the Arcadia Dunes. What did they first think about when Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy said they might buy the land?
Well, of course, there was a lot of secrecy at first because we were doing negotiations with the corporation, and we had to do that very quietly and, you know, in meeting rooms downstate and so on. So for a long time, we were busy working on it, and nobody knew. But there were a lot of hopes harbored on that land. The farm families, some of them the same ones who'd had to sell their land to consumers years and years ago, were still hoping to buy back their family home, family farms, and move back to the land. And it's a great orchard site for cherries and grapes and apples and so on. So they were all hoping to be able to buy it back again. And others were hoping that it wouldn't be developed so they can continue to visit it. But when we finally did spill the beans, there was a variety of reactions, some of horror that, oh, no, it's going to be developed, and people were really scared. They were scared sort of to the depths of their soul, and I think that's one reason why so many people rallied around to help preserve it. It was such a community effort where we had people from bakers to innkeepers to farmers to bank presidents. You know, everybody was pulling together, and what was wonderful is that with all those people pulling for it, you could have nearly an introduction to anybody you needed if you were trying to find money to raise or somebody to bend the governor's ear. There was somebody who could introduce you.
Raising the money to purchase the Arcadia Dunes was really complex. There were a lot of groups. There was government money, philanthropic money, private donations, a lot of moving parts. The Land Conservancy was really punching above its weight. I'm looking back, how did you folks actually manage to pull this off?
Yes, well, I think if we'd known just how impossible it was, we probably wouldn't have dared to start the project. It started by I was dreaming, looking at a bunch of maps and saying, wow, look at that big property. And of course, big is always good for land conservation. So I was just dreaming and thinking, well, let's try it. And my ally was Glenn Chown, who is the director of the Land Conservancy. And he just, you know, we caught fire together and said, let's try it. Of course, if we'd known what was involved, it probably wouldn't have started it. But it was so full of hope. It was such a campaign of audacious hope. And I think people realized that we were serious and we were passionate, but that we needed a lot of help. And they all came and rallied around, and we pulled it off by a miracle.
You note that the story of Arcadia Dunes really doesn't end, that obtaining Arcadia Dunes and Greenpoint Dunes was just a commencement. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the business of land protection, you can say that the day that the title transfers into your name is the day that you've preserved the land. But really, land continues on through time and space, and you do have to continue to take care of it. So just because the Conservancy owns a lot of that land now doesn't mean that it's safe. For example, nature preserves have to be loved over time and cared for. There can be timber trespass. There can be invasive species that come in and change the landscape. There can be illegal dumping. There can be climate change. There's so many things that can impact a landscape. And you need to continually groom the next set of people, the next set of stewards of the land, because human beings are only really here on this earth for a pretty short time, and we want the landscape to endure.
Are Arcadia Dunes and Greenpoint Dunes now open to the public, wide open? Can they go in, walk, hike, ski?
Yes. Greenpoint Dunes is just a couple miles north of Arcadia Dunes, and you can go and hike and be on that property. It's open to the public. And Arcadia Dunes is technically a larger landscape, so several thousand acres are open to the public for hiking and skiing and mountain biking and bird watching and everything, and hunting during certain seasons. But also some of the Arcadia Dunes land has been purposely transferred to private hands, and the land has been able to be returned to many of the same farm families that originally owned the land. And that's private land, so you're not allowed on that part. But it's subject to conservation restrictions, so there wouldn't be houses and buildings going up on that farmland.
But our orchards, I take it.
Yes, it's primarily orchards, some Christmas trees, some vineyards. Mm-hmm.
And that works well adjacent to the larger preserve?
You know, when you're preserving a smaller nature preserve, you can draw a line and say, here's nature, and we're going to make the boundary, and this is where you take your walk, and it's wild. And then, you know, you have the rest of the world. But when you're trying to preserve something large like this is, when you're trying to preserve an entire landscape, you have to integrate people and economic livelihoods into the whole picture. And that's what made this project exciting, is that it's big enough that it's not just one part that's has a line around it and says this is a nature preserve. Part of it's a nature preserve, but part of it's a living landscape with farms on it.
I'm wondering what the local people think of what you've done.
Well, there's always a wide variety of opinion anytime you get a group of people together, and that's no different than farmers or any other group of people. But most people, the process we went through, I think, is very open and inclusive and respectful. And I was the one leading a lot of the interactions with the local neighbors. And what we found is that I invited their opinions and invited their expertise into the process. And so by drawing on a local knowledge, we were able to make it a lot stronger and a better conservation plan than we ever would without them. So my hope is that they're quite pleased living as part of the Arcadia Dunes landscape.
Heather Shoemaker is the author of the new book, Saving Arcadia, A Story of Conservation and Community in the Great Lakes. I got to tell you, I thought it was a really good read, and I'm glad you wrote it for us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Coming up, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan has repeatedly said he should be judged by whether or not the city's population goes up or down. We check in with Detroit Journalism Cooperative partner Chastity Pratt-Dossey on the most recent numbers. And a documentary about the alleged teenage drug kingpin, White Boy Rick, debuts at the Free Press Film Festival tonight. We'll speak with the director in 8 minutes. Also, to some, a boat is simply a way to stay out of the water. For others, boats are art. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan is running for re-election. And from the beginning, Duggan has said there's one way to determine if he's done a good job in his first term.
I've said this over and over. I want to be judged on one standard. Is the population of this city going up or going down? And if 2017, the population of Detroit is still shrinking, I'm going to have a hard time convincing anybody they ought to hire me again.
The city of Detroit's population has been declining for 60 years. This week, Chastity Pratt-Dossey looked at the population issue in a Bridge magazine article, and she joins me now via Skype. Before we get to the numbers, why do you think Duggan singled out that as the way to measure success in his first term?
For 60 years, it's been the biggest problem that Detroit has had. And what kind of win would it be if he could say, after 60 years, look at what I was able to accomplish? I mean, it was a huge goal. It was, you know, audacious. And I think he was also encouraged by the fact that there's so much momentum going on in downtown and midtown. It would have been a huge win if he had been able to pull it off.
Your article notes that we won't have census estimates for the city of Detroit until May, but you've been reviewing trends, calculating estimates. Let's start with the trends. Since Duggan's election, which direction have we seen Detroit's population go?
It's still going down.
You got numbers for us?
Well, what we know is that since 2010, the county's population has fallen by more than 71,000 people. And the city makes up a majority of the county's losses. So we have continued to see Detroit's population decrease. And the thing with that is the number each year is shrinking. The number of people leaving the city is shrinking. So in that vein, it's optimistic, I guess, because last year the city only lost 3,000 people.
So the decline is slowing.
The decline is slowing.
You've reviewed census data for Wayne County as a whole, which was released this month. What do those numbers show?
Same thing. You know, the county is losing people. And here's the important thing for people to understand, Lester. The population for Wayne County, 39% of that is the city. So what we know is that in 2016, the county lost about 7,000 people. Now, that would mean that, of course, the city is going to be some of that loss because the city takes up so much of the county. Even more to the point, 60% of the population loss for the whole county is typically coming from Detroit, you know, people leaving Detroit. So while Duggan was hoping that 2016 would be the year that we'd finally see an uptick, you know, and he had reasons to think that because there was only 3,000 people who left in 2015, you know, he thought 2016 was going to be the year. It's likely not going to be the year. Because you got 7,000 people leaving the county, and you got to know a lot of those people came from the city.
He's getting close, though. You know, Duggan knew he had a plan to fix streetlights. He knew the emergency manager had dealt with garbage pickup, and that would improve on the mayor's watch. It was a pretty good bet. He'd made some improvements in the Detroit public transit system, the bus system. And he'd have to start running for re-election in 3 years, not a full four. So that's not a big window for population growth in response to any improvements since municipal bankruptcy. Do you think he regrets saying he wanted to be judged by that single issue, population growth?
Well, I don't know, because he wouldn't comment on it for our story. I think they're still holding out hope that when the city numbers come in, that somehow, some way, that none of those 7,000 people who left Wayne County actually left the city. He's going to run again. So, you know, he said, you know, he would have a hard time winning if the population continued to decline. But yet there he is running. So I'm sure he'll have something politically expedient to say about it because he is running. So We'll wait and see in May what he says about the actual decrease when the specific number comes out for the city.
You talked to an opponent of Duggins in the race for mayor, State Senator Coleman A. Young II. What did he have to say about Duggins' performance standard population growth?
He basically said that when you look at what's going on in the neighborhoods and what's going on with employment, of course the population is going to continue to decline. He essentially said that for the mayor to make this claim that the population was going to increase shows that Duggan is not in touch with reality, not in touch with what's happening with regular folks. He's only really in touch with what's happening in the 7.2, you know, miles of activity around Detroit, downtown and midtown. That's what the opponent is saying. I really can't wait to see what Duggan says when these numbers come out in May.
While the mayor pegged his performance to population growth in Detroit, by what measure do you expect voters to use to judge him?
Right now, what you have going on in the city is two sort of camps. You have people who are really excited about the 7.2 and all the activity, the queue line, the arena, all of the new businesses, the new single and white people you see moving into, Detroit. But you have those people, of course, who have been in Detroit for generations, a lot of them low income, a lot of them in the neighborhoods that aren't seeing as much activity. So there are going to be two different standards by which he's going to be judged if you believe that these two camps exist. People in the neighborhoods are going to say, well, okay, what about, these blighted homes that are still awaiting demolition because the city is messing up, the demo project. And you're going to have people who live in Midtown who are saying, I see a lot of activity. I'll judge them based on that.
Chastity Pratt-Dossi reports for Bridge Magazine. She's a partner with Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Thanks for talking with us.
Anytime.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Tonight, a new documentary is holding its world premiere in Detroit as part of the Freep Film Festival. The title of the movie is White Boy. The subject is Richard Wershe Jr., but you might know him by another name.
The teenage drug dealer nicknamed White Boy Rick.
White Boy Rick.
White Boy Rick.
His name is Richard Wershe Jr.
Joining me now via Skype is the director of the film, Sean Reck. I didn't really know the story of White Boy Rick. His name came up when we did a recent series on juvenile lifers. But this story is so interesting, has so many twists and turns, and overwhelming evidence that an injustice is still being committed. Where did you first hear about Richard Wershe Jr.?
It's funny that I was doing press for my first movie, which is called A Murder in the Park. It's on, actually starts on Netflix next month. I was doing press for it a year and a half ago, and one of the reporters was someone who was a former inmate. And he said, I know another really crazy story if you ever want to look into it. It's this guy, Richard Wershe Jr. And when I did, I was flabbergasted and thought, man, this is something that would make a great Hollywood story. So I looked, and there were three Hollywood movies in the works about this case, which didn't surprise me a bit, but no one had done a documentary, something that has to really stick to the facts and make a compelling case to get people worked up, which is, the goal of this thing. When they see it, they will really be upset that this happened in our country. So that's why, my partners and I decided to move forward with it.
Let's talk about the background just a little bit. Wershe, how long has he been in prison and why is he there?
He's been in prison approaching 29 years, and he's there because he was caught as a 16-year-old with 8 kilos of cocaine in Detroit back in the mid to late 80s.
And he got a life sentence for that.
This is back during the crack era when people were demanding answers from politicians, and all they knew to do was to increase penalty, hoping that would work. And so there was a law called the 650 Lifer Law, in which anyone caught with over 650 grams could be charged with this law, and they could be sentenced to life without parole. The Supreme Court has since ruled that unconstitutional, so everyone was automatically resentenced to life with the possibility of parole. Richard Wershe Jr. has only had one public parole hearing, which was a fiasco. And it was pretty clear there that the powers that be in Detroit were never going to let him out.
Take us back to that period. Tell me about the reaction of the news media when this guy known as White Boy Rick was arrested.
The press that has to make a profit is sort of a slave to ratings. And they know, and I know from doing Crime Stoppers television programs, that you get higher ratings when you appeal to more of your potential audience. So the fact that they're reporting on drugs every night and they can actually report on this white kid was something they milked, so to speak. They ran stories on Rick more than once a week for months and months, and he became this caricature in Detroit. He was a small-time drug dealer, and there's some fascinating background to it, why he even got into the drug business. But he was a small-time drug dealer and never should have been sentenced like he was. And, you know, as the movie examines, you know, he actually got into the drug game at the request of the FBI. And a lot of people may not believe that, but the very agents who managed him appeared in this film and admitted all.
That was the really interesting thing. You got cooperation from the FBI law enforcement, convicted drug dealers who have no reason to help Wershe, investigative reporters, and others who all agree that there's something fishy about this guy still being in prison. How did you find all of them?
I relied on a network of journalists. One of our producers is Seth Ferrante, the Vice reporter who told me about the story. He helped, and an Oakland Press reporter named Scott Bernstein, who's Rick's biographer, also did a lot of legwork in getting these people involved and saying, look, if you don't tell your story, someone else will. And we got them all involved, and it's fascinating. There's one part of the movie where we've got a hit attempt being described by the hitman and the potential victim. I never imagined being able to edit something like that together when I started in this business.
Right. This guy was convicted for 30 murders, and he's released, but White Boy Rick is still behind bars. With all of these people, the former FBI agents, the people about whom Richard Wershe was informing the FBI, Detroit police, all saying it's past time to release this guy, who's working to keep him behind bars?
The main opponent up to now was Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, who, you know, just believed that he was a danger to society, she says. And, you know, some say that she was being very loyal to some old friends and rabbis in politics who gave her a leg up. You know, some of the people who were targeted by these investigations in which Wershe assisted. But last year she decided that she's not going to oppose his release anymore. And he's actually, the parole board right now is considering whether to give him another public hearing, and they should vote on that in April. So it's possible he will get out here sometime this summer, we're hoping.
You played it pretty straight. It's not really an advocacy film, and you do not have a call to action, but you do note there's only one person who can do anything about Richard Wershe Jr.'s release. How do you expect viewers to react to that last line in your documentary?
I hope they contact the governor's office. You know, up to now, he's deferred to the parole board, but that parole board was appointed by him. You know, if he wanted to take action, he could. Probably not great optics with everything that's going on in Michigan and some of the accusations levied against him because of the infrastructure problems in Flint. But, you know, this is somebody that if people knew the whole story, they'd understand why he would release this man and at least give him the rest of his life to try and build something or accelerate his parole possibly. So the fact that the parole is moving forward, if the governor even made a statement like, boy, that young man sure seems to have served his time. Hopefully that, you know, something like that would help the parole board with their decision.
As I mentioned, this story had so many twists and turns, surprising twists and turns. For you, what was the most surprising part of the story?
The most surprising part of the story was how poorly all of the adults behaved in the very beginning. I mean, there were five or six people involved in this thing, starting with his father, who could have said, stop, this is insane, this is not happening. And everyone was blinded by their careers, by money. Nobody cared about the welfare of this child, and that was a child. And now everybody holds him accountable as if he organically got into the drug trade. And if it weren't for the FBI encouraging him to get into the business, who knows if he would have ever even seen or touched a drug.
The film is White Boy from Transition Studios. The documentary debuts tonight at 8 p.m. at the Detroit Film Theater at Detroit Institute of Arts. Sean Reck is the director. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we're on the topic of the Free Film Fest. I'll be moderating a discussion after the film The Ethanol Effect from Detroit Public Television is shown at Imagine Theater in Novi at 6 tonight. Maybe I'll see you there. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For several months now, we've been traveling around the state talking to people who make useful things with their hands. We're calling this series Artisans of Michigan. This time, we're in Tecumseh, Michigan, in Mike Thompson's garage. Some people call him Canoe Mike because, among other things, he makes wood canoes. How did he learn?
I read a book. I was working in Maine, and I talked to a guy, one of my coworkers, said that he had built five canoes, and he told me the name of the book that he, you know, used to build the book, learn how to do it. I bought the book and literally read that book for 5 years before I got up the nerve to try it. And that boat's still in operation.
What drew you to making boats? Why boats?
To fish.
It's a lot cheaper to go to Cabela's and get something.
Well, actually, it's cheaper to go to the grocery store. But I've always had boats. I've always liked boats. And if we went in the backyard, you'd see I've got three or four of them back there. So it was a natural thing to say, well, I think I can do that.
Now, most of the time, Canoe Mike builds canoes, but his latest finished project is like a rowing shell.
It's called the Liz. It's an 18-foot pulling boat, but it's designed to have a drop-in rowing unit, which is a sliding seat, which is the same thing that the racing shells use. It's a wood strip construction, quarter-inch by three-quarter-inch strips glued together and then covered with fiberglass inside and out.
Tell me about the oars.
Well, the oars are made out of redwood. And that makes them very lightweight, and I'm hoping that they're strong enough. I'm going to give them a try and see. That's the fourth set of oars that I've made because I've also built a 14-foot rowing sailing boat. It's a good rowing boat, but it's a fixed seat. I don't get the exercise that I'll get out of this boat.
Why would a rowing boat be interesting to you?
It's pretty.
It's not for fishing, though.
Actually, I have things that I fasten to the gunwale, and I put a rod in there and set a lure out when I'm rowing, and I've got to be careful where I row so I don't go through the weeds. But I drag lures behind, and I actually catch fish that way.
Mike Thompson says his first year out of retirement, he built four boats, but he's not going to do that again. It ate up all of his fishing time. Now he does one boat during the winter, and the rest of the time he's found something that doesn't take quite as much time.
I make boats, but in addition to that, I make paddles. I make stand-up paddles. I make bent shaft paddles, all kinds of canoe paddles, laminated shafts, laminated blades. And I've started making Greenland-style kayak paddles as well.
Thompson says you can drop by, talk with him while he works, but he likes to work alone most of the time.
I don't think I could do it any other way. I worked in construction for 41 years, and my work was always subject to being critiqued. I don't have to worry about that. If I mess up, then I'd fix it, you know, and the finished product is all that matters.
He says he'll build a canoe or boat to show at the various shows or display at big stores, but he'd rather a customer just tell him what they want, and he'll build it. That's Mike Thompson in Tecumseh, our latest Artisan of Michigan. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Hey, have a great weekend.